We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning
to you.
All right, on this lovely holiday weekend.
Yeah, what are you doing working today anyway?
What are we doing here?
Hey, I'm making,
well,
I'm making holiday pay.
Week.
That's what I'm making. All right. Well, big fireworks planned for Gasworks Park, or at least watching them from Gasworks Park.
Yeah, and what is a 4th of July story without mention of excrement? So we thought we'd work ours in early. The 4th of July fireworks show at Gasworks Park is going to be larger than usual this year because, of course, of the cancellation of the one on Elliott Bay, and so more people are expected to go to Wallingford this year. SPD is estimating maybe 75,000 people are going to be in that residential neighborhood this afternoon, and Gasworks Park, of course, only holds a small fraction of that. So the rest of the crowd goes into the neighborhood itself, and SPD is actually expecting that once Gasworks Park becomes full, which will probably happen hours before the actual fireworks display, that they're going to funnel the rest of the crowds into the Wallingford residential area, particularly up Wallingford Avenue, which has pretty good sight lines for views of the lake and of the fireworks. Well, there's only one problem with this, which is that the city is not has not provided any porta potties or trash receptacles for anywhere in Wallingford except for Gasworks Park itself, and is refusing to do so. So the Wallingford Chamber of Commerce and neighborhood businesses in Wallingford are actually having to pay out of their own pockets for services that should be provided by the city. And they've gone to the city hall with this and the Nichols administration and gotten absolutely nowhere. So, you know, if you go to the fireworks display tonight and you happen to produce some garbage or you have to do a number one or number two, think of Greg Nichols while you're doing it because, he apparently doesn't think that, that any of us should, have to do those sorts of things while we're watching fireworks displays. So it's a small, yet I mean it's not small certainly for the businesses in Wallingford, but it's certainly an indication of what the priorities are for the Nichols administration, because you can be sure that if this were an issue downtown and it were downtown businesses and retail establishments that were, you know, concerned about people coming into their establishment drunkenly insisting that they have a right to use the bathrooms to do their business, this would be treated with the greatest urgency and by City Hall, but not so much when it comes to neighborhoods.
Darn. A lot of jokes come to mind, but none of them are valid via the FCC filters.
That's because you like potty humor.
It's
or porta potty humor.
Porta
in this
potty
case.
Humor.
Unfortunately, it's true. All right, let's move on to national and the debate about the healthcare bill.
Yeah, Maria Cantwell is currently doing her healthcare reform listening tour. She's doing a lot of listening. She's doing a lot of talking, and she's not saying very much. Or
she was against it before and after she was for it.
She was for it, and then she wasn't for it, and then she was sort of for it, and then she's not sure what she's for. Just as long she's for something that works, but. All the other major Democrats in the state, Patty Murray and Democratic Representatives Jim McDermott, Norm Dixon, Jay Inslee, all support a government-run public option plan as part of the health care reform bill. Maria Cantwell stands out as not endorsing that, and she has said about, what, three or four different things to different
people.
She
said several different mutually contradictory things. The only real way to explain with any consistency what Maria says she's for is if she's trying to redefine what the word public option means. That is to say that she's come out publicly in favor of the co-op idea being pushed by centrist Democrats Conrad of North Dakota and Baucus of Montana, and she's certainly ideologically of a mind with those folks in the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party, but she seems to be trying to get away with a semantic trick where she calls a co-op idea, which is a nonprofit but certainly not public, and she's referring to that as the public option.
And it's not.
It's not. And we've talked on this program the last couple of weeks about how fundamentally flawed that idea is,
and
too.
And why that's not a good alternative to a public plan or, more importantly, a single-payer plan, which is what we really need. Meanwhile, Barack Obama has been doing his own public forums to try to sell his health care reform bill and some of the options in it, including the public plan, the public option plan. On Wednesday, he told a group of folks at a forum that a single-payer system couldn't be done in the U.S. because so many Americans have their health care insurance through their employer plans. He's absolutely wrong when he said that. You know, two new government reports this week show that private health insurance coverage is at a 50-year low. Both the Census Bureau and the CDC came out with their statistics showing that about 65% of non-retired Americans had their insurance through their employer in 2008. In the 1970s and early 80s, it was nearly 80% of Americans that had their health insurance coverage through their employer.
Yeah, and I'm certainly a person. I mean, I had an employer-based plan in the early 80s, and I don't now. I haven't had
for
years.
Exactly. A lot of people don't anymore. And, you know, the 2009 stats are going to be even lower because, you know, if you look at the job losses so far this year, more than 2 million people have lost their jobs since the beginning of this year. And I'd say closer to 3 million people.
And this doesn't count a couple of things. Number mm-hmm. one, it doesn't count the number of workplaces that have dropped health benefits as a benefit because of the economy and because of the struggling nature of some of these businesses. But above and beyond that, even if you have an employer-based plan, the deductibles are higher, and very often it doesn't cover basic expenses and it doesn't cover most of people's health care needs.
Yeah, exactly. And people are not getting it paid by their employer. A lot of people who do have health care coverage through their employer are having to pay a large portion of the premiums. For some folks, it's not an affordable option anymore. And a lot of people give up insurance through their employer that's available to them because they simply can't afford it. So that's another thing at issue as well. So just the fact that a lot of people, not a majority really, if you include retired Americans in that statistic as well, it's not a majority of Americans anymore who have their insurance through an employer like it used to be. If you look at it from the view of reality, then a single-payer option makes a heck of a lot of sense. And, you know, if the rest of the world can do it, why the heck can't we?
Well, and there was also a poll that came out this week that showed this didn't test for single-payer because, of course, that's a non-starter. Nobody could ever possibly have that in the United States. But it did test for public opinion on the so, quote-unquote public option without specifying what that public option would be. 83% of Americans support a public option, which really underscores once again the disconnect between what the public wants, and in this case what the public wants also happens to be very good public policy, and what in lobbyist poisoned Washington is considered practical or doable.
Yeah. And in fact, the Senate this week rolled out their revised health care reform bill. Now, we've talked about this before in prior weeks, how the House introduced a bill that was basically a wish list with no options for how to pay for it. And they're leaving it up to the Senate to figure out both what should be in the plan and what kind of steps need to be taken to pay for it. The revised health care bill that the Senate Health Committee came out with is estimated by the Congressional Budget Office to cost about $611 billion over 10 years, so they've cut it considerably from the $1 trillion plan they initially announced. This new plan would require all employers with more than 25 employees to provide insurance coverage or to pay a tax of $750 per each full-time worker or $375 per year for each part-time employee. Government would run the public plan option, which is what Obama supports and what many Democrats support. It would be run by the DHHS. The bill would also impose fines of $1,000 on Americans who don't buy coverage. So anyone who chooses not to buy coverage would have to pay a tax of $1,000 per year. Government would provide subsidies for...
Which is actually cheaper than buying the coverage in almost
exactly,
every case.
Exactly. Government would provide subsidies for the poor and for lower middle-class families to get them to try to buy insurance coverage. And it would ban insurance companies from refusing to cover people with pre-existing conditions, which should have been done long ago. And it would also create an insurance exchange where people who have lost their jobs or are self-employed could go to look for lower-priced options for health insurance coverage. Now, as Jobs said, that $1,000 tax on people who don't buy insurance, for a lot of families, your monthly insurance bill is over $1,000, so paying 1 month to opt out of having to pay for insurance coverage would seem to be a pretty good deal for a lot of people.
Particularly when that insurance coverage, especially if it's based on individual packages, which, you know, if you don't have access to an employer-based plan is what you're left with, those packages often cover so little that you're going to wind up paying for most of your health care costs out of pocket anyway.
Anyway, yeah.
It's really only catastrophic coverage, which, you know, if you're young and healthy, you know, a lot of people are willing to take that risk.
Yeah, pay the $1,000 and get out of having to buy that insurance.
All right. All right, moving on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, you know, we're starting the second half of 2009 now that we're into early July, and I just want to remind folks that in the beginning of the year when the economy really plummeted and things looked really bad, a lot of the rosy, the economic opportunists, the people who are very optimistic, the optimistic economists, were saying, well, you know, things are bad now, but they'll pick up in the second half of 2009. I just want to remind people that the second half of 2009 is starting right now.
This is the point at which a summer vacation reference is needed. Are we there yet?
Right, exactly. Exactly. So it might be a good idea to take a quick look at the state of the economy right now, because a lot of people are sort of hoping we're at the very bottom and starting on the upturn right now.
And
again, yes, we've been hearing that all throughout the second quarter of the year, of course. But we had some statistics this week that showed that things may not be on the upturn quite yet. You know, after a couple of months of showing job losses, of slowing job losses in April and May, June saw another uptick. You know, we had about 500,000 people each month out of work in the early part of this year. And then in May, job losses fell under 500,000 really for the first time when you had only about 322,000 people out of work. Now here in June, we're seeing that it's an uptick again to about 467,000, so close to that 500,000 mark again. So folks are saying, oh, well, maybe we're not at the bottom yet. And certainly the unemployment statistics show that. Now, official unemployment is at 9.5%. If you include all of the other people not counted by official unemployment, the unofficial unemployment rate is about 16.5% and possibly higher than that. In addition, this week, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both reported upticks in delinquent mortgages. And analysts noted that recent delinquencies are driven by, of course, recent job losses, that the biggest source of growth in foreclosure starts is in prime loans. That's people who have good jobs, have good credit, and simply can't pay their mortgage. It's a direct sign of the straining economy and the terrible state of people's personal finances. And as if we needed another indicator of that, we had a bunch of states this week, including the state of California, simply throwing up their hands and saying, we can't balance our budget. We now have to issue IOUs in order to pay the bills. And that's really showing you a fall in tax revenues. And most states, unlike the state of Washington, rely on state income taxes for their tax revenue. Income taxes, of course, go up and down based on people's personal incomes.
Yeah, although they're not as volatile as property taxes and sales taxes, which is what Washington state is dependent
on. Well, they're not indexed to inflation the way those two taxes are, and so it's much harder for it to track the state of the economy. But when the economy's bad, all tax revenue goes down, and this is just a sign of that.
Yep.
All right. Anything else on this week's economic news?
No, let's move on.
All right. Sarah Palin making some headlines last
week.
Who?
Yeah.
No. Well, you know, regardless of what people in liberal bastion like Seattle think of her, Sarah Palin, by all public opinion polls, remains the most popular Republican in the country. That, of course, is a pretty low bar at this point.
Yeah.
But but she surprised a lot of people by picking a Friday before a holiday weekend for a hastily assembled press conference 5,000 miles away from Washington D.C. to announce that she is going to resign as governor of the state of Alaska, which has set off really a firestorm of speculation as to what she is up to. There are a number of possibilities. One is that she just wants to spend more quality time with her family, which nobody believes, particularly because, you know, why bother with the old Bush White House trick of picking the slowest possible time in the news cycle to time your announcement unless you really don't want people to dwell on what you're doing. Another is that her many ethical lapses while governor of the state of Alaska are about to lead to another indictment or bombshell. There's a rumor going around this morning that there's a federal investigation proceeding against her. Another possibility is that she's cashing in on her fame and celebrity, both to pay off those legal expenses from the various investigations. She just signed a lucrative book deal, and because she can still pull a remarkable amount of money for speaking engagements to loyal Republican fans of hers. And then the fourth possibility, of course, is that she's running for president in 2012, which while the
she hasn't got a prayer.
Well, she's sort of the Dennis Kucinich of the left, not in terms of her popularity, but in terms of what the leaders of her own party think of her, that they would be very unlikely to ever willingly give her the nomination. But, you know, strange things can happen in politics, and we're still 3 years away from that. And the Republican Party at this point is pretty leaderless. So, whether that's a realistic possibility and whether she thinks that's a realistic possibility are two different options. But lost in almost all this coverage are a couple things. Number one is that she's walking away from a commitment she made to the voters of the state of Alaska who doing so probably for reasons of personal aggrandizement, either political or financial, which really speaks a lot to her character or lack thereof, in my opinion anyway. And the other is this real conflation at this point between a political figure on the national scale and celebrity culture. And we certainly saw this on the Democratic side with some of the way that Barack Obama was treated, particularly during his campaign last year. But it's really kind of come to head with Palin, who, from the standpoint of being the governor of a relatively small state in terms of population that's 5,000 miles away from Washington, D.C., I mean, the fact that we're even talking about her is somewhat surprising. We certainly didn't talk about Tim Pawlenty, another GOP hopeful, when he announced last month that he wasn't going to be seeking a re-election, presumably so he could run for president in 2012. But the fact that she has become such a celebrity staple, both because people love her and because people hate her, it's a lot of how our political system is being run these days. And we talked about last year how much of the appeal of Palin to the Republican base is a lot of people saying, well, I'd like her to be president because she's just like me. Well, you know, you don't want the most powerful person in the world to be powerful job in the world to be some filled by somebody who's just like you. You want to be somebody who's, you know, exceptionally competent. And even then, as we're seeing with Obama, it might not be an ideal outcome, but at least you want that as a minimum qualification. But we've really been seeing the dumbing down of political culture in this country, and we're seeing it once again with this news story.
It's a cult of personality thing. I think it's a longstanding problem with American politics that because no one can really talk about substantive ideological differences, nobody can really talk about what they believe in and what they would like to do, you know, in terms of broad ideological concepts, that what you get instead is this cult of personality thing, people voting for people because they like who they are and how they talk. We saw that even with Barack Obama. And so it makes it a lot easier for these people, once they do get in office, like Obama has done, to do a 180 on a lot of his major campaign promises. Palin, I think, just exemplifies that. She's got nothing going for her, really, other than her personality. And she's cashing in, buddy.
All right, let's move on to Supreme Court ruling this week.
Yeah, just very briefly, we had once again a Supreme Court ruling this week. In this case, a ruling that reversed a lower court ruling that nominee Sandra Sotomayor was a part of in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court ruling for industry and against the environment, and it underscores once again, I'll just make this a very brief point, every single environmental case that came up before the Supreme Court this year under the Roberts Supreme Court, the ruling came down for industry and against the environment. And we're seeing this increasingly in terms of consolidation of power, whether it be governmental power or corporate power at the Supreme Court. But when push comes to shove and it's a conflict between the two, under the Roberts Supreme Court, we're seeing corporate power being favored. And once again, this comes back to the consequences of the Democrats ruling over on those nominations when they happened 3 years ago.
All right. Moving on to international and last week's coup in Honduras.
Yeah, we had a coup in Honduras. Folks probably know that. But it's interesting because the UN, the OAS, all the neighboring governments condemned the coup. Even the conservative governments in Mexico and Colombia said that President Zelaya needed to be reinstated. And to everybody's surprise, I think the U.S. stepped in and said, no, we support Zelaya. We don't support this overthrow of the democratically elected president of Honduras, which I found to be kind of refreshing after decades of U.S. influence in that part of the world, backing up dictators and trying to overthrow democratically elected governments. Let's not forget that Honduras was the staging area for the Contras during the Reagan administration in the 1980s when the U.S. government sought to overthrow the democratically elected leftist-leaning government of Nicaragua.
Yeah, and the Tegucigalpa embassy was also notorious as far as supporting human rights abuses in Honduras itself.
Yeah, and Honduras is by no means wealthy country. There's a very, very large underclass of people who are in extreme poverty there, and there's a very small and very wealthy elite of landowners who run the country. And because Zelaya did a few things like he raised the minimum wage by 60%, he started rubbing elbows with Hugo Chavez of Venezuela and Fidel Castro and other folks in Cuba and some other left-leaning or populist rulers of other countries in South and Central America. He's become extremely unpopular with the very wealthy landowners in Honduras, and that's really why they put him out of power.
Although it's worth saying at this point that left-leaning governments are now by far the majority in South and Central America, and mm-hmm. he's right within that mainstream.
And that's what the elites in Honduras are afraid of. They're afraid of following in the footsteps of those other nations.
Yeah,
but
well,
it's time. Really.
I don't think it's just the elites in Honduras that are worried about that.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to Pakistan.
Yeah, the war in Pakistan has expanded to a second front this week. There have been two fronts going on in the war in Pakistan, in the Swat Valley in the Northwest Frontier Province, and there's been kind of low-level fighting in Waziristan to try to support the U.S. troops in Afghanistan. This week, two tribal leaders in Waziristan tore up their peace agreements with the Pakistani government. The names of the two leaders are Gul Bahadur and Malvi Nazir. I hope I got those right. Both have turned their focus away from Afghanistan and are now aiming at the Pakistani government, and they both have blamed the missile strikes from U.S. drone aircraft. Now, I just want to remind people back in, 2002, when the Bush administration was demonizing the Saddam Hussein government for potentially having drone aircraft that they deemed part of the list of weapons of mass destruction, that now drone aircraft are used routinely by the U.S. government in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and also probably in Iraq, though we don't hear about that very much. But in Waziristan, there have been some 40 drone strikes in the Pakistani tribal regions since January of this year, and the worst was just last week in South Waziristan, where an attack killed about 80 people at a funeral.
Yeah, so, and another one killed about 13 just last night.
Yeah, and the Pakistani government, about a week or so ago, issued their first formal their first formal protest with the State Department over the use of drone aircraft in Pakistan. And I just want to point out that that use of drone aircraft, which we condemn Saddam Hussein for, has now opened up a bigger front in Pakistan and exacerbated the conditions there.
Yeah, and this comes in the context of the Pakistani army planning a full offensive, quote-unquote, in South Waziristan in the near future. So it's definitely going to heat up very soon.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Afghanistan.
Yeah, Afghanistan. This was the week that U.S. troops, the additional U.S. troops that were pouring into Afghanistan, started a new operation called Strike of the Sword in Helmand Province. It began on Thursday morning. Helmand is the part of Afghanistan where most of the opium is grown, and I just want to point out that Afghanistan produces some 90% of the world's supply of opium. About 4,000 Marines and 650 Afghan troops have started the operation. And just so that people know, because you don't get this very much in the U.S. media, in coverage of Afghanistan, that the Pentagon is sending thousands of U.S. troops to Afghanistan right now. By the end of the year, they expect to be up to about 68,000 troops. And that, however, is still about one-third of what's in of the U.S. troops that are in Iraq right now, and about half of what are expected to be there by the end of the year.
All right. And Iraq.
Yeah, Iraq saw a couple of interesting things this week. It was the June 30th pullout date where U.S. troops were supposed to have been pulled out of Iraqi cities. But, you know, an unspecified number of U.S. troops are going to remain in the cities in order to assist and advise Iraqi police and Iraqi troops. And there are currently about 131,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. All are supposed to be gone by 2011, but, you know, daily violence in the city of Kirkuk, including massive suicide bombings, have pointed out that there's still the risk of civil war. And if a civil war happens over the northern oil fields, as I think it will, that U.S. troops could be pulled back in very quickly.
All right. And open bidding?
Yeah, there was open bidding for Iraqi oil fields this week. It was mostly a failure. Seven of the eight fields that were up for bid had no takers. This was really because the Iraqi government wanted to pay service fees of about $2 per barrel of oil extracted in order to get those fields up and running again. And you know, it's been
no one to collect them.
Well, what
they want the bidders
No. The Iraqi government has to pay service fees to these oil companies in order to get the oil fields up and running. And what they wanted to pay, what some of these companies wanted to charge, was up to $20 per barrel of oil. And what
wanted higher service fees.
Yeah, they wanted higher service fees from the government of Iraq. Iraq only wanted to pay $2 per barrel. And I'm going to explain why they have to pay these service fees. It's because the U.S. government has spent decades bombing the Iraqi infrastructure, and with the sanctions and with the wars and the neglect of the Iraqi oil infrastructure, the Iraqi government has to pay somebody to get those oil fields up and running, and they're trying to pay these oil companies. Oil companies want more money than the Iraqi government is willing to pay.
Even though the oil companies were responsible for a lot of the American policy in the first place.
Yes, exactly.
All right, Iran.
Yeah, update on the arrests that happened of opposition leaders, hundreds of them, in the wake of the uprising and protests after the election in Iran. Some of those captured opposition leaders have been seen in the last couple of days on videotape confessing to wanting to overthrow the regime, etc. Now, those are false confessions, obviously, and almost certainly were the result of torture. So here we have the torture of politically useful prisoners producing false confessions that can be used by the ruling regime. If you wanted to use it in Karl Rove's formulation, all with the intent of permanently marginalizing the opposition to create a permanent majority. Where have we heard these tactics before? Happy 4th of July.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in places you find free periodicals, like in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, bars, other places. We can also be found in the King County Public Library system. And we can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.